Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, we hear about past Christmas traditions in the United States. Later, Gina Bennett answers a question from an English learner named Noor. Finally, we hear The American Story, To Build a Fire, by Jack London. But first,
from VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Today, Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith present a special program on Christmas traditions in the United States during the first half of the 19th century. During this period, there was no set way of celebrating the day, which was not yet an official holiday. Communities around the country honored the day in different ways. Some observed Christmas as an important Christian religious day, honoring the birth of Jesus. Others celebrated the day with parties, music, drinking, and eating. And some communities did not celebrate the day at all. But it was during this period that Americans began to reinvent the holiday. They combined ancient Christmas traditions from different cultures with modern American influences. Here are Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith.
In 1819, the popular American writer Washington Irving wrote a series of five essays published in a book called The Sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, Gent. The essays describe a wealthy British landowner who invites his farm workers into his home to celebrate Christmas. The landowner recreates a traditional Christmas as it would have been celebrated in the distant past. Irving praised this looking back to ancient traditions. He liked the idea of different levels of society coming together to enjoy a festive and peaceful holiday. Washington Irving seemed to express concern about the lack of such unifying Christmas traditions in modern America.
Penny Restad wrote a book, Christmas in America, A History. It shows how Americans began to slowly shape Christmas into a unifying national holiday during the first half of the 19th century. She describes how Christmas had different meanings for Americans who came from different cultural and religious backgrounds. Many immigrants brought Christmas traditions from their own countries.
Religion played a big role in how an American might celebrate the holiday. Calvinist Christians banned the celebration of Christmas. But groups such as Episcopalians and Moravians honored the day with religious services and seasonal decorations. By mid-century, Christian groups began to ignore their religious differences over the meaning of Christmas and honored the day in special ways.
Christmas became an important time for families to celebrate at home. More and more Christian Americans also began to follow the European traditions of Christmas trees and giving gifts. Christians believe that the tree represented Jesus and was also a sign of new beginnings. German immigrants brought their tradition of putting lights, sweets, and toys on the branches of evergreen trees placed in their homes.
This tradition of setting up a Christmas tree soon spread to many American homes. So did the practice of giving people presents. As these traditions increased in popularity, the modern trade and business linked to Christmas also grew.
As Christmas became more popular, some states declared the day a state holiday. Louisiana was the first state to make the move in 1837. By 1860, 14 other states had followed. It was not until 1870 that President Ulysses Grant made Christmas a federal holiday.
Americans already knew old Christmas songs that came from England and other areas of Europe. But many new American Christmas songs started to become popular. For example, in 1849, a religious leader from Massachusetts wrote the words to "It Came Upon a Midnight Clear." The song "Jingle Bells" appeared 7 years later. And a year later, a religious leader in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, wrote the song "We Three Kings of Orient Are."
And of course, no discussion of Christmas would be complete without talking about one of the holiday's most famous representations, Santa Claus. This character is based on the story of Saint Nicholas, a Christian holy person believed to have lived in the 3rd century. Saint Nicholas became known as a protector of children. In his role as a Christmas hero, different cultures have given him different names. These include Sinterklaas, Kris Kringle, and Father Christmas. But for most Americans, his most popular name would become Santa Claus.
In the 19th century, many Dutch immigrants living in the United States celebrated the feast of Saint Nicholas on December 6th. St. Nicholas was especially important to New Yorkers because of their history as a Dutch colony. In 1809, Washington Irving published his History of New York. It lists St. Nicholas as the patron saint of New Yorkers. He describes the saint wearing a low hat, large pants, and smoking a pipe. Does this description sound familiar?
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question about the words assessment and evaluation. What is the difference between assessment and evaluation? Noor. Thank you for writing, Noor. This is a good question. Many people use the terms assessment and evaluation interchangeably. That means they see little or no difference between them in most cases. The terms are related. They both involve performance and education, but they are not the same thing. it is a mistake to use them interchangeably. Assessment focuses on student learning, documenting what students know and what they can do. Assessment has many purposes. They include finding out a student's overall ability, measuring to what degree a student has gained control of an identified set of criteria, and providing students with information about their strengths and weaknesses. Assessment is a continual process. Its goal is to help students improve. Here are some sentences using assessment. Teachers should use classroom assessments to inform instruction. The students completed a weekly assessment. The school uses a variety of assessment tools. Evaluation often focuses on the performance of an organization. Evaluation involves using criteria and evidence to find out if an organization is meeting its goals. Evaluation only happens at set times, and its goal is to judge the quality of an organization. Assessment can be a part of the evaluation process. That is because assessment results are often used to make judgments. Here are some sentences using evaluation. The class was canceled due to results from the curriculum evaluation. The school district completed its special education program evaluation last month. The governor focused on the lack of school counseling evaluations. Although assessment and evaluation are both used in education and relate to measuring performance, they have different focuses, purposes, timing, and outcomes. The terms are also used a lot in other fields such as finance, medicine, and engineering. Please let us know if this explanation has helped you, Noor. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Gina Bennett.
Gina Bennett joins me now to talk more about this week's Ask a Teacher.
Hi, Ashley.
This week's program talked about some differences between assessment and evaluation. Many people use those terms interchangeably, but in the story, you said that would be a mistake.
That's right. Assessment and evaluation are different processes and have different outcomes. They are not synonyms.
Why do you think people sometimes use these terms interchangeably?
Well, they are closely related. They're both used to gather information, check progress, and make decisions. Assessment is even part of the evaluation process.
But the main differences involve focus, purpose, timing, and outcome.
Right. For one thing, assessment is individual focused. Each student is assessed separately from others. But evaluation is group focused. Students would be evaluated as a group, not individually.
That is definitely a difference. What is the difference in outcome?
Outcome is probably the biggest difference. The goal of assessment is to use information to help students improve, but evaluation uses information to make a judgment.
And that is related to the difference in timing, too. Assessment is ongoing, but evaluation has a final end.
Yep, exactly.
Well, I'd like to thank Noor for asking that question, and thanks to you, Gina, for speaking with me today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Our story today is called To Build a Fire. It was written by Jack London. Here is Harry Monroe with the story.
The man walked down the trail on a cold gray day. Pure white snow and ice covered the earth for as far as he could see. This was his first winter in Alaska. He was wearing heavy clothes and fur boots, but he still felt cold and uncomfortable. The man was on his way to a camp near Henderson Creek. His friends were already there. He expected to reach Henderson Creek by 6 o'clock that evening. It would be dark by then. His friends would have a fire and hot food ready for him. A dog walked behind the man. It was a big gray animal, half dog and half wolf. The dog did not like the extreme cold. It knew the weather was too cold to travel. The man continued to walk down the trail. He came to a frozen stream called Indian Creek. He began to walk on the snow-covered ice. It was a trail that would lead him straight to Henderson Creek and his friends. As he walked, he looked carefully at the ice in front of him. Once he stopped suddenly, and then walked around a part of the frozen stream. He saw that an underground spring flowed under the ice at that spot. It made the ice thin. If he stepped there, he might break through the ice into a pool of water. To get his boots wet in such cold weather might kill him. His feet would turn to ice quickly. He could freeze to death. At about 12 o'clock, the man decided to stop to eat his lunch. He took off the glove on his right hand. He opened his jacket and shirt and pulled out his bread and meat. This took less than 20 seconds, yet his fingers began to freeze. He hit his hand against his leg several times until he felt a sharp pain. Then he quickly put his glove on his hand. He made a fire, beginning with small pieces of wood and adding larger ones. He sat on a snow-covered log and ate his lunch. He enjoyed the warm fire for a few minutes. Then he stood up and started walking on the frozen stream again. A half hour later, it happened. At a place where the snow seemed very solid, the ice broke. The man's feet sank into the water. It was not deep, but his legs got wet to the knees. The man was angry, The accident would delay his arrival at the camp. He would have to build a fire now to dry his clothes and boots. He walked over to some small trees. They were covered with snow. In their branches were pieces of dry grass and wood left by floodwaters earlier in the year. He put several large pieces of wood on the snow under one of the trees. On top of the wood, he put some grass and dry branches. He pulled off his gloves, took out his matches, and lighted the fire. He fed the young flame with more wood. As the fire grew stronger, he gave it larger pieces of wood. He worked slowly and carefully. At 60 degrees below zero, a man with wet feet must not fail in his first attempt to build a fire. While he was walking, his blood had kept all parts of his body warm. Now that he had stopped, cold was forcing his blood to withdraw deeper into his body. His wet feet had frozen. He could not feel his fingers. His nose was frozen too. The skin all over his body felt cold. Now, however, his fire was beginning to burn more strongly. He was safe. He sat under the tree and thought of the old men in Fairbanks. The old men had told him that no man should travel alone in the Yukon when the temperature is 60 degrees below zero. Yet here he was. He had had an accident. He was alone. And he had saved himself. He had built a fire. Those old men were weak, he thought. A real man could travel alone. If a man stayed calm, he would be all right. The man's boots were covered with ice. The strings on his boots were as hard as steel. He would have to cut them with his knife. He leaned back against the tree to take out his knife. Suddenly, without warning, a heavy mass of snow dropped down. His movement had shaken the young tree only a tiny bit, but it was enough to cause the branches of the tree to drop their heavy load. The man was shocked. He sat and looked at the place where the fire had been. The old man had been right, he thought. If he had another man with him, he would not be in any danger now. The other man could build the fire. Well, it was up to him to build the fire again. This time, he must not fail. The man collected more wood. He reached into his pocket for the matches. But his fingers were frozen. He could not hold them. He began to hit his hands with all his force against his legs. After a while, feeling came back to his fingers. The man reached again into his pocket for the matches. But the tremendous cold quickly drove the life out of his fingers. All the matches fell onto the snow. He tried to pick one up, but failed. The man pulled on his glove and again beat his hand against his leg. Then he took the gloves off both hands and picked up all the matches. He gathered them together. Holding them with both hands, he scratched the matches along his leg. They immediately caught fire. He held the blazing matches to a piece of wood. After a while, he became aware that he could smell his hands burning. Then he began to feel the pain. He opened his hands, and the blazing matches fell onto the snow. The flame went out in a puff of gray smoke. The man looked up. The dog was still watching him. The man got an idea. He would kill the dog and bury his hands inside its warm body. When the feeling came back to his fingers, he could build another fire. He called to the dog. The dog heard danger in the man's voice. It backed away. The man called again. This time the dog came closer. The man reached for his knife, but he had forgotten that he could not bend his fingers. He could not kill the dog because he could not hold his knife. The fear of death came over the man. He jumped up and began to run. The running began to make him feel better. Maybe running would make his feet warm. If he ran far enough, he would reach his friends at Henderson Creek. They would take care of him. It felt strange to run and not feel his feet when they hit the ground. He fell several times. He decided to rest a while. As he lay in the snow, he noticed that he was not shaking. He could not feel his nose or fingers or feet. Yet he was feeling quite warm and comfortable. He realized he was going to die. Well, he decided, he might as well take it like a man. There were worse ways to die. The man closed his eyes and floated into the most comfortable sleep he had ever known. The dog sat facing him, waiting. Finally, the dog moved closer to the man and caught the smell of death. The animal threw back its head. It let out a long, soft cry to the cold stars in the black sky. And then it turned and ran toward Henderson Creek, where it knew there was food and a fire.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.